morning. I hope you had a great week. We had a very fun week, a busy week. We went out to California, to Orange County, California, and I had to take a deposition this week of a gentleman who works for the Toyota Motor Corporation. And this fella in this deposition was from Japan. It was his second time to the U.S. He seemed to speak absolutely zero English. My Japanese is less than that. And so the way a deposition works is you've got a court reporter who sits there and types every word that's said. You've got a video camera on the witness so that there's a videotape being made. Then you've got the witness. You've got the lawyer like me who's asking the questions. You've got lawyers representing the witness and the other parties. And that's generally what a deposition looks like. The idea of a deposition is you get testimony under oath in a video and in a booklet that you can play during a trial so that the witness does not have to appear live. You can also use it at a trial if the witness appears live and the witness tells a different story than they told in their deposition. You can say, well, time out. You know, were you telling the truth then or now? And so a deposition, the court reporter is allowed under law to put the witness under oath. Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? Witness takes the oath, and the deposition begins. The problem with this deposition is, I didn't do Japanese, and he didn't do English. So we had to have another person in the room, the translator, the interpreter. So I would say, what is your name? She would look at him and say, blah, 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 blah. He would look at her and say, blah, 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 blah. She would look at me and tell me what he said. Very difficult, especially with the names, because the words get translated. You know, things like, gee, our car is very safe. I understood it when he said that. But when he said, the head of this group is Togaki, I can't even remember the guy's name, but it's said so fast, I can't follow it because those aren't words I'm used to hearing in English. So I'm having to sit there and I'm writing out phonetically what the name is so that I can then ask questions about Mr. Togaki or whoever it may have been. Later on, I'm putting some documents out there for him to see because I had questions about some documents. The documents had been written in Japanese, but I had a certified translation of the document. So I'd give the witness the Japanese copy. The translator got a Japanese and an English copy, and I've got the English copy. And I'd say, now, sir, if you'll look down midway down the page, and she'd look to him and say, blah, 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 blah. I'd say, there's this sentence that talks about the Ministry of whatever it is in Japan, their equivalent of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And I said, so when I started talking about that, well, he says, blah, 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 which she looks to me and says, he says it's not on his page. Well, I just, if it were Spanish, I could maybe crib it together because at least we've got the same alphabet. But this is entirely different. I mean, I'm sitting there saying, well, it's about that far down. So I said, let's find the words around it and see if we can get to it. Well, the bottom line is he did not, the translator did not translate the name that I was using for the Ministry of Infrastructure, Land, and Transportation, MILT, in Japan. The translator wasn't translating it the same way that the translator in the document had. And it's not that either one of them was dishonest. It's just this is there aren't rules on this. This is kind of freelancing. And so we finally figured out what was being said. And then I finished that deposition and I started typing this lesson. And it's really interesting because if you were to look, I want to skip slides for a moment. Let me go see if this works to do that. Now let's go one more. Yes, if you were to look at the English Standard Version of the beginning of Esther. Bless you. The English Standard Version says, now in the days of Ahasuerus. If you were to read it in the Hebrew, I translated Esther in one of my classes, Ahasuerus is the way we pronounced it. If you were to get your NIV says this is what happened during the time of Xerxes, and it calls this fella Ahasuerus Xerxes. Now that'll spin your head. And what's going on here? Well, I would suggest to you that just as in the deposition where we had the problems with Japanese into English, we have even more of a problem here, because what was happening in Susa, Persia, is happening in Persian. And then we get it into the Hebrew Old Testament, and it's turned into Hebrew. Then they take that and they translate that into our English Bibles. We have three chances with three different alphabets and three different sets of pronunciation to get this changed. So, for example, if we were to take the word for king in Persian and we were to write it out in the Persian that was the official Persian that Darius, the father of this king, had instituted in Persia, that's what it would look like. That's their word for king. Would you like to pronounce it? This is the best I can do on the pronunciation. That first sign is an X sound. Then you have a SH sound and an A sound and a yah sound and a TH sound and an E sound and a yah. You'll notice both yahs look the same if you look carefully. They had this writing system that had syllable sounds to it, not just letters. Now that gets put into Hebrew. Hebrew doesn't even have some of those sounds. So by the time you get Hebrew, of course, is its own language as well. Persian, the what's now Farsi for Parsia, the Pars people, the Persians, that's an Indo-European dialect. Hebrew is a Semitic dialect. Their word for king's melech. And so you've just got melech there. So you got this Persian idea of king. You've got it in Hebrew. And then in English, we write it right. No translation needed. King. Well, this problem is one of the many things that makes Esther so much fun to study. So let's look at Esther, and as we look at it, if you have, you got your graggers? Some, you got? Good. That's to help you pay attention. You young people who have those, it's to help you pay attention. If this were a real Purim festival, if we were in synagogue celebrating Purim, which is when they would read Esther, when they do read Esther, the kids get these, or some of them are like $6 ones that have the wood little clacker that goes around. It basically sounds like when we were kids, what would happen when you put the baseball cards on the spokes on your bicycle and would ride your bicycle with it. Ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. Okay? That's because there's a really bad guy in the story of Esther named Haman. And the kids, to make them pay attention during the reading of the story, every time they hear Haman, they're allowed to take their cracker and go like this. Which is really fun to get to do in church. Can you imagine during Pastor David's sermon if the kids were told, every time you hear this, you get to stand up and go. They would pay attention. So there you've got that. Now, you've also got your Haman's ears. We'll talk about those later as well. You don't throw those at the speaker. With that, I want to tell you the story of Esther is a marvelous story. It's so well written. It's just 10 short chapters. But the chapters are really wonderful. It's a story of palace intrigue. It's a story about a hero and a heroine who stopped the genocide of the Jewish people. It's a story that follows the life of an orphan girl to becoming the most powerful woman in the world. It's a story of a pompous fool and an absolutely funny chapter of how he falls. It's a splendid story that I absolutely love. And it does start, as I showed you, in the days of Ahasuerus or Ahasuerus. Now, I've inserted into your written lesson some different little things. I've tried to pull them out so that we could keep the flow of the story, but you can follow. I won't go through all of those written things, but some of them are there because it's an interesting story. We're talking about a time of history that is known from other sources outside the Bible. And so historians have had a fun time and an interesting time, and the cynics have had a ball trying to figure out how the biblical story might mesh with history. Because some scholars think that this is a novella. It's a short little historical short story that's kind of made up factually to teach a message. Others are emphatic that it's very historical in what it says and in what it does. I think God in Scripture is able to use all types of literature to teach his points. But I think more likely than not, this is a very historical story, and that's where I land on it. And some of those reasons are in the text. I think the text indicates it's a historical story. And so I approach it and believe that to be true, and I think it meshes well with history. But I've put some of those notes in there for you to look at, and you can decide as you want to. If we were reading it in the NIV, though, it would talk about the time of Xerxes. Now, why the difference? Here's the coin. That's the coin from the day of this. That's supposed to be the Persian king. He looks kind of goofy. He's got a big old eyeball. I guess they wanted him to say that his eye was everywhere. The name in Persian is Kshayarsha. We thought about naming Will that. In Hebrew, it's Ahasuerus, the German W. Ahasuerus. Now, you're sitting there saying, well, why in Hebrew do they take this Persian king, that is a historical king, I might add. Kshayarsha is an actual Persian king of history. You just don't know him by his Persian name. But the Hebrews, they hear Kshayarsha, and a lot of times Hebrew and some other languages in that area would add an A sound for a word they're borrowing from a foreign language. So that A is probably indicative of it being a foreign word. And once you do that, you've got the Kshayarsha, which is very close to Kshayarsha, supposedly. So that's how it gets into Hebrew. That is an accurate Hebrew translation, if you will, kind of a cross between a translation, transliteration, I guess, of the name. In English, in the English Standard Version, they put Ahasuerus, which is how those letters of the Hebrew would form out into English. But if you were reading Herodotus, the Greek historian from that day, he wrote on the Persian Wars because Persia was fighting Greece all the time. And he just called him by the Greek name, Xerxes. So your New International Version is telling you that Xerxes was the king because they figure you may have seen the movie 300, where Xerxes went to fight. I don't think that's really what he looked like. I've seen the coin. Give Hollywood their due. Now, the story begins with banquet number one. This story is built around 10 banquets, and the banquets filter out, and smack dab in the middle of the banquets are the anti-banquets. We'll talk about it. But it starts out, and the story is built around the structure of 10 banquets, 10 being a nice, complete, total number. It's an easy thing to do. You have one banquet for every finger on your hands. Banquet number one, the king Ahasuerus, King Xerxes, is throwing a banquet. It's 180 days long. Now, they didn't eat for 180 days. Not even I could do that. But what they did is over that 180 days, they had a banquet for all. It was a bring everybody in, have the big banquet, probably a planning meeting for him to go invade Greece again, which he did not do successfully very well. But banquet number one. So they have banquet number one. And then on the heels of that, they have another banquet for the people who are the citizens of Susa, who put up with all the foreigners coming in for 6 months for the earlier banqueting. So this is a 7-day banquet that the king is throwing. And while the king is throwing banquet number two, his queen Vashti is throwing banquet number 3 just for the women. This story is built around banquets. Over half of the Hebrew occurrences of the word feast in the Old Testament, over half of them happen in the book of Esther. This whole thing's built around eating. Queen Vashti is throwing her own banquet. It's banquet number 3. And while she's throwing banquet number 3, the king, who's a little bit tipsy at this point, the king calls her out and says, "Hey, go get my queen, have her put on all of her royal best. I want her to come in here. I want to show her off." Now, I thought about asking my wife up on stage. But I've learned from this story not to do that. Vashti did not like it. She refused the king. She said, "No, I'm throwing a party. And I'm not going to leave just to come in because my drunk husband wants me to parade in front of all of his drunk friends." At which point, the king goes into a rage. Now, it's interesting to read the stories. We get most of our history of this king outside of the Bible in the writings of Herodotus, the Greek historian I was telling you about, who was a contemporary. He was born while this king was reigning, or right before the king started reigning. And Herodotus writes up in 3 of the books on his Persian wars a lot about this king. You can read it. It's fascinating. This was a quick-tempered king who could really fly off the handle for irrational reasons. He also would change his mind all the time. Not a real steady guy. In fact, historians say this king was the beginning of the end of the Persian Empire. You can chart it. The empire was growing. And starting with this king, until Alexander the Great conquers it. So the king, he gets real upset, very mercurial king, and so he basically says to his wise men, "What should we do?" And I like the text, because the wise men, and he's got 7 of them. Esther says he's got 7, and Herodotus said he had 7. That's the way the kings did it. They had 7 counselors, 7 wise men. So the king says to him, "What do you think we ought to do?" And the wise men respond and they say, "Look, this is not only against the king that Vashti's done wrong. She's done this against all the officials, all the peoples, in all the provinces of your land. What the queen has done, the queen's behavior, everybody's going to find out. Women talk. The queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt. And they're going to be saying, 'King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she didn't come. Why should I? She has just sown the seeds of rebellion in every house in the land. She must be dealt with swiftly. Dethrone her. Take her off her throne.'" Now, if in fact Vashti is the Amestris, who was the queen that Herodotus talks about, and there is the names, when you start doing all the language differences, the names can mesh. So if she was Amestris, then there's a little bit more to the story than the Bible writers are telling us, in the sense that she and the king had been on the outs for some time already. The king had evidently perhaps had a fling that the queen did not approve of, and the queen was paying the king back, if you will. And the king was not too happy with it. History aligns very well with this story. So she doesn't come, she gets dethroned, and now you got a king with no real queen. Don't get me wrong, don't feel bad for the guy. He had a massive concubine. But nobody to wear the crown and parade at the parties to be the official queen who's going to give the official offspring or something like that. So he calls his counselors back together and says, "What should we do?" And they said, "That's easy. Have a Miss Universe pageant. Miss Universe, circa 480 BC. We'll have it in Susa, Persia." And so He does. And there is an orphan Jew named Hadassah, which is Myrtle, likely, in the Hebrew. Myrtle, yeah. Myrtle. We'll just use her English name. So there's this orphan girl named Myrtle who has a Persian name, Esther. And because her mother and father are dead, she's been raised by her dear uncle Mordecai. And so you have this wonderful story. Mordecai says, "You're a beautiful young lady. I'm entering you in the Miss Universe contest to become queen of Persia." Now, the key is, don't tell them you're Jewish. You stay in the closet on that. But get in there and go for it. So she gets enrolled. She meets the head eunuch. Of course, they're going to have eunuchs in charge of the harem and the virgins. He meets the head eunuch, or she meets the head eunuch. Head eunuch says, yeah, you make the first cut. Come on in. I mean, 6 months of makeup, training, 6 more months of perfumes and oils. Get the rash gone. Everything they need to do to get her skin perfect. And then she enters into the contest. Now, I tried to find a song to fit today. And you may find this odd, but there are some guys from Houston named ZZ Top. And they honestly put out a record called Esther Be the One. I did have to change the lyrics a little bit. But let me play for you the story up to this point while you munch a little bit on your Haman's ears. Can we get some volume? Yeah, ZZ Top's not made to be listened to low. So, yes, thanks to Phil Keggy. Esther wins the beauty contest. She's going to be the queen. I mean, we get it. Here's what it says. Let's see. Esther chapter 2. Esther chapter 2. Now, the king loved Esther more than all the women. That means she won. She won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And we now have a Jewish, admittedly, won't tell anybody she's Jewish, but a Jewish queen on the throne, reason for banquet number 4. So everybody feasts and everybody's happy. While this is going on, Mordecai, her uncle, who doesn't really get to communicate with her anymore. That's one of the natures of being the queen's wife or one of the queen's virgins in harem. You're not allowed to associate with any men unless you have special permission of the king or unless the man is a eunuch. So that keeps everybody happy, supposedly. So at the king's gates, we've got some ruins of some gates here to give you an idea of how big and massive they were. That's where a lot of action was happening. And Mordecai is hanging around the king's gates, maybe around the back, maybe around the corner, but he overhears in hushed tones two eunuchs as they plot to kill the king. So Mordecai gets the word out to the king. He rats out the two conspirators. An investigation is done. Turns out Mordecai was right. In the king's journal, diary, chronicles, they enter in, these two rascals were trying to kill the king. Mordecai found out about it, ratted him out. After investigation, it was discovered, rascal's dead, it's over. Just seems like a little side story put into the plot. Now, put the side story back to the side, and let me tell you about another character. And any child with their gragger better be ready. There's another character. There's this man we learn about named Haman. The Agagite. That not even sound bad. Agag was an Amalekite king that was the downfall, the final straw that broke the camel's back on King Saul. God told King Saul through Samuel the prophet, 1 Samuel 15, go kill all of the Amalekites. Don't take any plunder. Don't take any booty. Don't leave anyone alive. King Saul goes. And by the way, my perspective here is these Old Testament stories of don't leave anybody alive, just a side note here. So God's saying kill all of the children and everything. Absolutely, if they stayed there. But not, I mean, I got my kids and I see they're coming. If I honor God and respect God, I'm leaving. I don't care to stay there. But if you're going to stay there in rebellion against God, he takes it out. Well, that's not what King Saul does. King Saul kills a bunch of them, but he saves the king, Agag. And Samuel goes to him and says, why did you spare the king's life? You weren't supposed to. Well, I thought it'd look real good, you know, to have him around as a trophy. No, that's not what God told you to do. God's fed up. He's taken the kingdom from you. You're not an obedient king. Now, that's important because we've already been told that Mordecai is descended from Saul. He's a Benjaminite who's a Kishite who's descended from Saul's lineage. So you've got Mordecai in this story, a descendant of Saul, and now we're meeting a descendant of Agag, the king that had been King Saul's downfall. A studious Jew who hears this story is going to appreciate that. Because Haman gets promoted up in the king's, King Ahasuerus, King Xerxes, gets promoted up in his administration. And as a result, all of the people below Haman are expected to bow in front of Haman. And it looks like Mordecai probably worked in the government in some way, shape, form, or fashion. That's why he's always hanging out at the king's gate. But Mordecai is clearly an underling below Haman. And Mordecai is expected to, every time I say Haman, you're free to do it. It shows you're paying attention, man. And the parents will look at you and go, that's my boy, or that's my girl. So every time Haman walks around, anybody below him on the totem pole is supposed to bow. But Mordecai won't. Mordecai's not going to bow to him. And it eats away at Haman. Haman is so upset. And the story is set up for Saul versus Agag, the sequel. The descendants have come back in for the big battle and the big fight. So Haman decides he wants to get rid of a bunch of, all of the Jews. He just says, look, Mordecai's a Jew. I'm tired of this. We're killing them all. We're going to kill every one of them. And he takes the Pur, the lot. Some scholars think it's that pyramid dice that was used in the royal game of Ur, a Persian game. And he starts rolling the dice, casting the Pur, throwing down the lot, and decides that on the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, they're going to wipe out all of the Jews. So he takes a legal document to the king. And he says, you know, there's a group of people that just don't honor the laws, they don't honor anything, and there's a real interesting pun there in the Hebrew. The difference between killing them and making them slaves is the difference between an aleph and an ayin. He in essence is saying, it's almost as if he's letting the king believe, sign this and we'll enslave them all and teach them a lesson. When in fact what it says is sign this and we kill them all. So the king signs the decree, and the day is picked, and all of the Jews are going to be annihilated, and it's time for another banquet. Now, the word gets out, obviously, that all the Jews throughout the empire are not only to be killed that day, but anybody who kills a Jew is entitled to take as plunder whatever the Jew possesses. House, land, crops, everything. Motivation for people to go kill a Jew. Mordecai finds out about it. And Mordecai goes to Esther through a eunuch and says, you got to do something about this. You got to approach the king. You got to put a stop to this. Esther sends back and says, no, you don't understand court etiquette. I can't just approach the king. If I approach the king and the king doesn't ask me to come, it's punishable by death. If I approach the king and he sees me and he knows he hadn't asked me to come, the only way my life is spared is if in some act of mercy he extends the golden scepter. And Mordecai, and so the eunuch comes back, and it's kind of like the game that Becky and I will play on the phone when the kids answer the phone. Tell your mom I love her. Mom, dad says he loves you. Tell him I love him more. Mom says she loves you more. Tell her she's not old enough to know how much love someone who's 51 can have. That I used to think when I was 50, I loved a lot. But it's just, dad, that's too much to say. No, just tell your mother. Mom, dad said something about being 51 and loving you more. Becky, well, tell your dad that a man cannot understand love like a woman can. So it's understandable he would think that. But there's no love. No, mom, that's too much. And of course, Becky and I can hear each other because the phone's real loud. But we still like playing this middleman game with the kids. That's almost what's going on here. So Mordecai sends the eunuch, says, go tell her. She says to the eunuch, well, you go tell him. And Mordecai sends word back and he says, listen, don't think you will escape. You're a Jew. You may be a closet Jew. Nobody may know you're a Jew, but you are a Jew. You will not escape. Any relative you've got will not escape. And there'll be some rescue that comes from some other corner if you don't do this, but who knows? But that God hadn't put you here right now to do this very thing. And those 10 banquets, we're in the middle of them right now. And you remember we've talked multiple times in this class about the chiasms and the way that things will be paralleled out to put emphasis on what's in the middle. And the emphasis between those 10 banquets falls right here, between banquet 5 and banquet 6. Is Mordecai, Esther, and the anti-banquet. Esther says, okay, me and my people, we're going to fast for 3 days, my lady attendants. Mordecai, I want you and everybody else, all the Jews, to fast for 3 days. We'll do the anti-banquet. Through prayer and fasting, and the word prayer is not used, but it's assumed. That's why you're fasting. It wasn't a diet. During this time of fasting, a time of dedication and prayer, Esther's willing to approach the king and hopefully walk away with her own life as well as the life of others. Now, fortunately, ZZ Top had another verse for us, so we can catch up if you miss something. And that's what she does. While she's fasting, she starts cooking a banquet. Why not? Banquet number 6. She goes right outside the throne room where the king can see her. King looks out, and he hadn't had reason to summons her for some time. She thought maybe she was on the outs with him. But he looks out, and he sees her, and he extends the golden scepter. Esther, why are you surprising me at work? Esther says, hello. He says, tell me what you want. Whatever it is, you get it. She said, all I want is for you and your minister Haman to come to dinner. I've been cooking a banquet feast for you. Now, we know from the writings of Herodotus and other writings that part of the culture was that the king almost always dined alone. The Persian king had his own room where he would dine, and even the people he was eating with would eat in an adjoining room as he dined with them. But not so in this case. In this case, that's not a good picture for the banquet, because this was a banquet for three. So the three come. Haman, of course, he's ecstatic. Yeah, it's kind of like, wow, you mean to tell me dinner for three? The king, the queen, and me. Yeah, it's a pretty good day in Persia. He's feeling it. His career is going straight up. He's been promoted. Everything's great. Goes to dinner. Dinner goes off super. He doesn't spill his soup. The hummus stays on the pita bread. The chicken souvlaki, it was so good. As the dinner's winding down, they're having after dinner drinks. And the king says, knowing the ways of women as he did, okay, Esther, there has to be more to the game. Now tell me what you'd like. Anything you want up to half my kingdom, it's yours. Burp. Esther says, If I could, my one request, my only request, is that you and Haman might come back to dinner tomorrow night. King says, well, I'm not doing anything. Yeah, I'll see you tomorrow night. Haman's going home, feeling so good, walking down the street, singing. And there's Mordecai. And Mordecai does not bow like everyone else. Mordecai stands there and watches him walk by. And Haman, whose life is seemingly wonderful, goes home to his wife and his friends, and they say, how did it go? How was dinner with the king? He says, well, everything was perfect. I wore the right clothes. I fit in. I mean, it's just like three peas in a pod. Me, Vashti, Ahasuerus, we're like, but I want to tell you what has ruined my day. Why does everything happen to me? Walking home, Mordecai didn't bow. And I don't care how good the day's gone, I will not be happy while that Jew shows me that utter disrespect. So the wife and the kids, the wife and the counselors, they say, hey, well, why don't you just have some gallows made and hang him. Don't wait till the 13th of Adar. Just kill him now. Then we'll wipe out the rest of the Jews later. He says, that's brilliant. Hey, guys, work through the night, get the gallows built, and make them tall. I want everybody to see him hanging. And tomorrow, I'm going to have my Mordecai. Goes to bed, wakes up. The problems that were on the way home are no problem now. He's able to sleep like a baby. Meanwhile, we get told that at the palace, the Persian king is having insomnia. I think that's where Stephen King got his idea for his book, Insomnia. The Persian king is having insomnia. He can't sleep. So what's he going to do? He calls in some guys and says, hey, would you read me the book about all the good things that have happened in my life? I can't tell if that's late night TV for him and he wanted to be entertained, or he's hoping it'll put him to sleep, or maybe he thinks there's a problem that he's overlooked and he's got to fix it. But they're reading through, and they read through, and they tell him about Mordecai, and he reads the stuff about Mordecai. Remember that side story where Mordecai saved his life by exposing the conspiracy? The king says, hey, did we do anything for that guy? They said, no, you never did anything. No, thank you note, fruit basket, nothing? No, nothing. Ah, geez, that's not right. He says, I got to do something. And so, look, Is anybody at work this early? You got anybody out there? Well, guess who came to work early? Oh, yeah, Haman. He's coming to work early because he's going to work with one thing in mind. I got to talk the king into giving the death sentence to Mordecai. So he's going to work. Zippity-doo-dah, zippity-ay. And king says, anybody out there yet? Yeah, Haman is. Haman, come on in. Now, as far as Haman knows, the only thing going on is the king and he and the queen had marvelous dinner the night before and are dining again that night. Of course, he's feeling really good that he's the only one at work at this early hour of the day. The king and he, you know, two peas in a pod, early bird gets the worm. Of course, who likes worms? But, he's there. And the king says, in what I think is the funniest chapter of the book, he says, hey, tell me this. Let's say there's this guy who works for me. And I really want to show him some honor. I'm really wanting to let everybody know this guy is pretty special in my heart. What should I do for him? Of course, Haman's thinking, this is all about me. What would I like? Let me see. I know what would feed real well into this whole Mordecai situation. King, this is what you should do. Take actual kingly regal clothes you've worn, put them on this fella, put this fella on one of your king's horses that wears a crown. Scholars used to make fun of that passage and say, look, this is so historically inaccurate, no horse wore a crown, until they found the documents that showed that the Persian king's horse wore a crown. But anyway, put him on one of your horses that wears a crown and have one of your noblemen lead him through the city, a witness, declaring to everybody, bow down, this is what the king does to the person he wants to honor, who's so dear to his heart, who's so wonderful to the king. That's what you need to do. King says, that's just brilliant. I want you to go do every bit of this for Mordecai. What? Mordecai. In fact, I want you to be the one to lead him around on the horse. And do not fail to do anything that you have just said. Well, that's just not a great thing. Haman goes home. He's got this much time to get ready for the banquet. He's all dusty and horse smelling from doing all of this all day long for Mordecai. Wife says, did you get him? Where is he? Is he going to hang tonight? He says, oh, look, this has not turned out well. And the wife and the friends who last night were saying, hang him high, tonight are saying, oh, wait. Well, he's a Jew. You're probably going to fall in front of him. This whole thing's not going to work. Sorry. And at that point, there's a knock on the door from the eunuchs ready to take him to Queen Esther's for dinner. So he shows up. He's just not happy. The dinner's going. The after-dinner drinks. The king says in banquet number 7, now what can I do for you? Esther says, I only have one request. King says, anything you want up to half my kingdom? She says, look, I'm just asking for my life and the life of my people. King says, what? And she says, look, you signed an edict that said all the Jews get destroyed, and I'm a Jew. And if you had signed an edict that said, had that little change in that one vowel, if you had signed an edict that said all the Jews are enslaved, I wouldn't complain. But that's not what it said. The king's, he doesn't know what he's done. He says, what did I do? Who did this? Who's responsible? She goes, him, Haman. The king is livid. The king gets up and runs out. The king comes back in, and as the king comes back in, see if I can find this quickly. As the king comes back in, he sees, it's in chapter 7, starts down at the bottom. And the king, if you see that in verse 8, and the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine, and he walks in the room just as Haman falls on the couch where Esther was. And the king says, are you going to assault the queen in my presence in my own house? You know, they're reclining to eat. So Haman falls down on the queen on the sofa as the king's walking back in. Very poor timing to fall. Interesting pun, though, because this is the same word, this fall, napal in the Hebrew. That's the same word for the, if we go back to this, for the rolling of the dice. The dice fell for the poor, for the picking the day. And we'll see a couple of times in the story how after that it's always Haman falling. So the king says, what should we do? The eunuchs say, well, you know, Haman had built some gallows for Mordecai, the guy you were honoring today. Why don't you just hang Haman on those? King says, great idea. So Haman gets hung on the gallows. And Esther says, now can you call off the kill? King says, no, that decree's gone out. Decree can't be changed. Esther says, but can't we do something? King says, yeah, we can do something. What should we do? So Mordecai and Esther come up with the idea. Esther presents to the king that says, okay, we'll just declare that the Jews can gather together. They can have weapons. And if anybody tries to kill a Jew, the Jew can kill them and take whatever they have. King says, seems fair. So Esther finds the way out for the Jews. And you know what happens? Banquet number 8. Everybody's happy as the decree goes out of what's going to happen on the 13th and 14th of Adar. Those are the days the Jews are allowed to do it. ZZ Top put it this way. Maybe. And God saves the Jews. 75,000 Persians got killed in the exchange between them all. And it became a day of happy festivities. Happy Purim. Purim is the plural for Pur, the lot. So that's the happy lot. And that's when you eat your hamantaschen, your Haman's ears, because he lost his head. So you've got some of that. You've got his ears. And you get to play with the graggers. And if you're a good Hebrew kid, you can dress up that day in costumes and all the rest. Now, Purim as a celebration has been celebrated ever since. It's a two-day celebration. And it's marked not only by the reading of the scroll of Esther, but it's and not only the treats, but by the giving of food and by banqueting and feasting, understandably so. And there were those feasts held those 2 days. Those are feasts 9 and 10 in the book, banquets 9 and 10 in the book, and the book is basically complete. There's a wonderful chiasm in the whole book that I put into your lesson that I don't have time to get to, but I'd love for you to look at it. It's very interesting, very fun, very fascinating. What I'd like to do, though, in the last 3 minutes is give you the points for home. Point for home 1. Now in the days of Ahasuerus, which is the first verse in the book, peace to all his people, which is the last phrase in the book. Did you know in the entire book of Esther, God is not mentioned one time by name or title? Yahweh is not used. Adonai is not used. Elohim is not used. There is no mention of God by name or title in the entire book. And yet, God is in every verse. In every page. It's so apparent. It's the kind of thing where the silence speaks louder than the highest volume you could get. The whole reason the Jews are there, the whole reason Jews are Jews and not assimilated into Gentiles is because they're chosen people by God. The prayer and the fasting, that's the focal point between the five banquets on one side and the five on the other. is a time of seeking God. The comment from Mordecai, Esther, if you don't do this, it will still be done, was a recognition of God's faithfulness. And whether we name him or not, and whether we see him or not, and whether we express it or not, there's not a thing that's happening in your life or mine that God's not in control of. Point for home number two. The mouth that had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness, or the month of Adar, the month that had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness, from mourning into a holiday, that's the festival of Purim. There is a time to weep and there is a time to laugh, the preacher says in Ecclesiastes. There is a time for mourning and there is a time for dancing. We have grown up in this audience, at least, by and large, influenced by the American Protestant work ethic. And there are a bunch of my friends and a bunch of me that sometimes feels guilty over enjoying something and having a good day.
Well, we should not be enjoying it. This world is not my home. I'm just a passing through. My treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue.
And don't get me wrong. There is a time for mourning. There is a time for weeping. There is a time. But there is a time to laugh. And when God places some blessing in your life, it's okay to have a feast. Not gluttony. A feast. And it's right to praise God and to thank God for the joys and the blessings in this life. He's been good to us. We should thank him and enjoy his goodness. Last point. Who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? The most preached message out of Esther, and for a good reason, because God has a purpose for you and for me today. You don't exist today without God having a purpose in your life. If he did not have a purpose in your life today, you would not be here. Would you pray with me? Lord, we thank you for this story. We thank you for your hand in history, in the world, and in history in our life. We thank you for the history you have for us to live today. It's my prayer that we'll live seeking your kingdom and your purpose in our life today. May your will be done on earth today in our life, just as your will is done in heaven. Thank you, Lord, for your many, many blessings to us. We pray through Jesus our Lord. Amen.